Hello and welcome to episode 7 of season 2 of AS for Architecture with me, Ambrose Gillick. In this episode, I speak with Professor Gwendolyn Wright of Columbia University and presenter of PBS's History Detectives about her book USA, part of Reaction Books' Modern Architecture and History series, published in 2008.
It's one of the things that is intriguing about American modern architecture is that it's much less placeless than a lot of modern architecture is criticized for being. Not that there aren't countless examples of that, but there is and has long been a distinctive way that American modern architects, whether they are immigrants from Europe or from Asia or native born, they engage that local climate, its materials, its site, its particular landscape, and they make the architecture better.
AS for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture, and space.
Hello and welcome to AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to Gwendolyn Wright. Gwendolyn, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself?
Well, hello, Ambrose. I'm delighted to be here. I think this is a fascinating and crucial project. That I'm an architectural historian with a professional degree and a PhD from Berkeley, who recently retired from Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. Indeed, at one point, I taught in all three of those divisions. There were just too many meetings, so it was really hard to do. But it's been a matter of exploring and writing about the origins of American modern architecture, about various kinds of housing and houses and apartment buildings and supportive social housing, and looking at architectural hierarchies of gender and race and class at Frank Lloyd Wright, and also doing a book and other projects about French colonial architecture and urbanism and the ways that modern architecture can be used to dominate in a very intentional, if they felt at the time, good-hearted, civilizing vision, as the French put it. So I've taken a range of these kinds of topics.
So I want to come back to this Berkeley thing, because you can't throw in Berkeley. I don't know when you were at Berkeley. Let's say what, 19?
In the 70s, yeah. It wasn't smoking at the time, although they were doing plenty of smoking. Mm-hmm. But there was a powerful sense of hope and mission and wanting to improve the world, wanting to engage in environments, wanting to have a vision of modern architecture, which was the way that all architecture schools, or almost all architecture schools, thought about teaching architecture. But it was very geared toward belief in improving the world, in the kind of progress that is at the heart of modernism, less a stylistic approach, a lot of experimentation, a lot of research and design, looking at design methods and so forth, and an exciting place to be formed. I think it's had a powerful impact on me to have been on the West Coast and then come to New York City.
So are you a West Coaster, or did you go to the West Coast from the East Coast?
I was peripatetic, like so many Americans. Yeah, yeah. I was born in Chicago, grew up in Houston, Texas, where my father was a doctor, and then went to France for a couple of years. I came back and had a job as a journalist at Newsweek, as a mainstream publication, doing the art section, and then decided to go to architecture school because I wanted to write about architecture and to explore for different audiences, for architects obviously, but for the general public as well, why it looks the way it does, what it can do and can't do, and how we can learn more, all of us, not just architects, but everyone, about this mission.
So you went to university to study architecture with the intention of being a theorist and historian?
Yes, absolutely. And many of my friends, it was very funny because, as you know from teaching architecture, most people kept saying, well, you're running away from being an architect. That's the only way that you can really be a modernist, the only way that you can really use architecture. And I think there are, I did design a few buildings, but there are many ways to try to influence and improve the larger world. In fact, one of the things that is important to me, I've been a journalist, I've written for the New York Times and many other magazines and newspapers, but for 10 years, I was one of the four hosts of a program called History Detectives on our public broadcasting station that reached a million people. And we took on all kinds of topics, ranging from books and maps and weapons to architecture. Two of those, for instance, were someone asking, well, was it true that a rubber plant in Akron designed prefabricated individualized housing to avert a strike in 1910? And another person asked, well, is it true? I've heard a rumor that there was a German POW camp in rural Texas where the inmates actually plotted to worship Hitler in a secret basement. Both of those were true. But mainly we try to show people how you do history. That is, mm-hmm. keeping an open mind. You don't grab your idea first off, because then you'll try to prove that it's right. Mm-hmm. But how do you do research? How do you look at photographs and texts and letters and buildings and learn something from them, trace histories, deal with the inevitable confusions, and sometimes have to say, well, we think this is what happened. Usually we'd be able to be fairly clear. And these were all things that had not been researched before. Mm. But it was great fun. And it was also exciting for me. One of my favorite stories is that one day early on, I got an email from someone who I had met who was a very prestigious Renaissance historian at Princeton. And he wrote to say how enthusiastic he was about the show. And that afternoon, I was walking down the street in New York City, and a 18-wheel lorry drove by, and the truck driver leaned out his window and said, hey, history detective, I love your show. So the notion of being able to reach that kind of range mm-hmm. of people was very exciting. Yeah. Although I was and continue to be principally an architectural historian, it's always good to change your bearings, to look at things in a different way.
I think so. And that idea of transforming history into something that is using media to transform history into something that is amenable. I think you can correct me if I'm wrong. So we should probably say that we're going to talk about your book, USA Modern in the Modern Architectures and History, by published by Reaction Books, which you published this one in 2008.
Yes.
And I wanted to talk about it because obviously America is quite big and important, and it's something that we continuously touch on in our own teaching and in my own teaching and in our courses. So it's this beautiful book, and you've written this. It's a joy to read. A colleague of mine said it sits somewhere between Kenneth Frampton and Raina Banham as a kind of, which I thought was quite a nice way of putting
it. Very nice. It's a very nice statement about it.
Yeah, but there's this idea within it that you said this in one of your first emails to me, that you're kind of looking at the way that things, you're looking at modern architecture from an alternative perspective. So just as in History Detectives, and just as in your other work, you're looking at the kind of undercap with the sort of underlying foundations, which kind of I suppose, challenge a bit our heroic visions of history. You know, the idea that the architect is the master of the architectural and spatial and built environment, and we little people kind of look on in awe at them, which we kind of still buy into. I mean, we
do, and it's perhaps inevitable that those of us who teach and study architecture and who make architecture mm-hmm. will believe that it's crucial, but it's not autonomous to be doing it. And one of the brilliant things about this series, Modern Architectures in History, was the idea of looking at different nations, how they interpreted and built particular kinds of modern architecture. Mm. It's not universal, although it's still preached that modern architecture is the same all over the world and we are following similar ideas. And to some extent, a sort of Eurocentric idea that modern architecture began in Europe with a modern movement in the 1910s and 20s, and then was disseminated throughout the world, sort of like in a suitcase, brought to the US and to the rest of the world. Well, I don't agree with that. And I think it's not just in the United States, but really around the world, even within Europeans' practice, we can see very different concepts and design approaches from one country to the next, within a given country, by different classes and regions and groupings, and of course over time as well. So I was very impressed that they had decided to do this, but there were two interesting problems at the very start. The editor called me and said, "I'd like for you to do a book about modern architecture in the United States and Canada." And I said, "You've got to be kidding. You have a book, these will all be about the same thing. You have a book on Switzerland, and I'm supposed to do the United States and Canada? That's a very Eurocentric idea. You're presuming that Americans don't really think about what they're doing," which many Europeans have felt over hundreds of years, and that it's all monolithic. I won't do that. She fortunately accepted that and then commissioned a book on Canada. But I went on to say, and besides, Vivian, this is all very Eurocentric. Why don't you have a book on modern architecture in Brazil, in Japan, in China, in Israel, in many countries around the world? And she, to her credit, instantly agreed and has done so.
So, that's wonderful, but it does beg the question, what therefore, is the shared characteristic between all these moderns? Because if, as you say, modern architecture is characterized by its context and sociocultural, economics, environmental context, which it seems to be, then what is modern architecture? Or is there modern architectures? Do we go down the kind of pluralist line?
The series does have it be modern architectures in the plural. It's not as if they're autonomous within a given country. We know that there are conflicts and differences and changes over time in modern architecture and within different countries. But I wanted to do two things. One, to suggest the ways in which modern architecture was not brought over from Europe, as many people, when I was a student and young professor, still insisted. It was indisputable that the forms of modern architecture and the prime examples of skyscrapers and big factories and prefab housing, and schools and many things like this were designed by American modern architects in varied ways. And this was worth understanding. Not that it's autonomous, not that it is totally the same, and not these ideas are shared elsewhere, but they often began here and emanated from here. What the Europeans called Americanismo, even the Soviets were fascinated in the 1910s and 20s by the concepts and examples, this sort of joyous and exciting and very public-spirited approach to modern architecture, modern materials, and modern life that American architects took on. But I didn't want to just situate the star modern architects who I really admire and appreciate. I wanted to understand how American modern architecture happened. Now, I especially like that word because, did you know that happened comes from the Old English hap, which means luck. And so there is a certain element, inevitably, of chance, which can be good or bad, that affects every building, every project, and every form of architecture. But I've really focused in the book on five characteristics that, again, are more pronounced here but have spread out from here. One is a hybrid mixing of genres, programs, and indeed sources and aesthetics. Second, the outsized role of commerce and consumerism in American life. Third, industrial production that emphasizes diversity or choice, which of course was done largely to cover over the standardization and homogeneity that plague so much of modern life. Fourth was the role of the media, both popular and professional, in disseminating ideas and creating new stars. Even television has been very important in promoting American modern architecture from the beginning of its use in American households after World War II. And then fifth, most auspiciously, is the fact that Americans, by and large, have an environmental sensibility. They think about site planning. They look at the natural environment and feel inspired by it. And they want to protect it, especially today in this time. We're all now so aware of the ravages of climate change. And architecture can't solve problems like this. Mm. It can address it. And we can't ignore those problems anymore. You can't be an architect who says, oh, I'm not interested in environmentalism. Because guess what? You're going to affect it, whether you're interested or not. And so you'd better think about what you can do and how to modify even some of your fundamental ideas to be more responsive. And that's going on, especially among young architects.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That was very beautifully put. I read those 5 points and I was very interested in them. But there was the book is broad, and I think possibly too much for one single episode of this. But I was struck over and over again by this idea of finding that the way that finding that the notes that you make or the points that you make which relate modernist architecture and lay people over and over again, and the way that these two things co-produce each other, which does fly, certainly does fly in the face of the narrative about modernism, which is as a handed down elite kind of design ethos from the, you know, the pens of great men, almost exclusively great men. Or almost exclusively men. Sorry, you know, obviously Le Corbusier.
Not all of them great, but all, well, you know, they're all good ones.
Yeah, all, you know, Louis Kahn's and Asplund's and so on and so forth. You know, various stripes of extraordinary designers. But there is this idea that it's a handed down thing, and I think one of the differences from a European perspective is that this narrative actually generates an antipathy towards modernism per se. So modernism as an architectural style becomes sidelined in contemporary culture, built environment culture, because it has this elitist quality in Europe. Whereas this idea of a hybridity, a natural hybridity within the American modernist system, which is articulated by the media, but is also articulated by commerce and government policy. And I did want to touch on this, you know, the way that you write about Roosevelt's New Deal being a huge factor in the mainstreaming of modernism across.
Absolutely.
So there's this kind of reciprocity in the American system, which means that it's kind of bought into much more readily by the American public than over here, where it's still held, I think I'm right in saying it's still held somewhat at arm's length. And architects, as a consequence, remain marginalized from common discourse.
I very much agree with you. However, I would insist that there have been and still are many American modern architects who believe that they're really only designing for each other, that architecture is for architects, and that only they can understand things, and that the public is stupid and simplistic. And I know, but many architects believe that. And for a long time, many architectural historians gave a sense that this was true, that only we know what architecture is about, only we know why it happened. And it's a very narrow Procrustean bed to put ourselves in. The fact is that, of course, that's important. But in Britain, in France, in the Netherlands, in Brazil, everywhere in the world, there has to be a larger public to commission architecture, to be fascinated by great architects, to be excited by the challenges and opportunities of modernity. And perhaps because Americans have, really since the 18th century, but especially after the Civil War, which was ended in 1865, they have seen themselves as the leader of modernity. They have seen themselves as a culture, to some extent unified, although obviously contentious, that was modern and that would be designing and building and enjoying modern housing and modern workplaces and modern public places, libraries and schools and parks and department stores and all kinds of building types, because they were modern. They wanted change. They wanted progress. And there's been more antipathy about modernity in Europe. And again, among the elite of American architects, although there has been and is increasingly a sense of needing to sell it, needing to promote it, wanting to have an excitement. And again, this was brought to Europe more than the opposite, more than the sense of modernism in a suitcase. This Americanisme that Jean-Louis Cohen and others have written about really affected modern European architects. They wanted to have some of that same excitement, and understandably, not that they deferred to the problems, which are many of American life, but they saw the work, they saw the excitement and the innovation, and the changes in people's lives.
I think this is a really, when sour, down at the mouth Europeans like me encounter an American, we want hope and change. And you're doing a beautiful job of telling a story, because obviously when you read your theorists of the 20th century, Weber's and Marx and Arendt and so on and so forth. Not 20th century and Marx, but modernity is characterized as being alienating in some particular way, as abstracting and alienating, a thing which is sort of disfiguring reality and is damaging people and blowing apart social relations and killing off the earth and so on and so forth. There's loads of, it's rather bleak. It's rather bleak there. Yeah. And yet what you're saying and is that modernity fundamentally is democratic. America is democracy. America is democratic. And you get Alexander de Tocqueville's writing about this as he travels around America, noticing this kind of vast enfranchisement of the American people, this kind of permeation of democracy into in a way that, you know, the French couldn't even possibly imagine, certainly not the British. So, and then you use this phrase about excitement and opportunity, like modernity is excitement and opportunity, not alienation and abstraction and despair and staring at the television, but excitement and opportunity.
But it's really, really entirely because these things are real. They're all too real, and they have become more pronounced in modernity, in modern architecture even, in especially since the 1960s and 70s.
These more negative things?
These more negative things. Obviously, these were a major part of new intellectual life in the early 20th century with Weber and Marx and Freud and many others. But it's not simply that despite those problems, sometimes running away from or ignoring those problems, but despite them, there has been a fundamental joy and excitement and democratic expansion through American life. Really, across time, as you said, Tocqueville saw this in the 1840s, but I think that modern architecture, per se, really emerges after the Civil War. That's when we created corporations, and therefore they wanted new businesses and new factories and skyscrapers and excitement. We began using the term middle class in the 1870s, and middle class homes meant what they called AMI, all modern improvements, that you wanted for your home, that you, whether it was an apartment or a single family house or even a worker's flat or a worker's house in an ethnic suburb, which was pretty much how those were divided up. And it was always with a sense of sanitation, of HVAC systems, of plumbing, of mass production that would bring costs down. And once again, class is important because by and large, Europeans, well through the 20th century, the modernists were focusing on elite clients who could build beautiful houses and public buildings, and some work for working class or social housing. Whereas in the United States, the focus was much more on this new and expanding middle class who would be able to have better houses and new apartment buildings and new kinds of services. Now, again, I don't want to get too rosy about middle class America. There are a lot of problems there, but it has been extraordinary. And it was more egalitarian, putting aside our terrible racial differences and violence, there has been an expansion of the benefits of modern architecture to a much larger proportion of the public.
It's fascinating. So this plurality that you describe in modern architecture, which happens very early, I mean, two of the examples that you give are architecture schools of Mies van der Rohe's Illinois Institute of Technology, built almost exactly at the same time as Frank Lloyd Wright's building Taliesin. I mean, within 2 years, I think they are of each other, aren't they? Well, you've got these two vastly different visions of what it is to be modern. One from a kind of totemic figure from Europe, and one from, I never quite got my head around that Frank Lloyd Wright as a modern architect. That's probably probably need to see a therapist about that. But I don't know. I found him too confusing. A bit like thinking of Rennie McIntosh as a modern architect. I find it difficult, perhaps because I got a narrow idea. But anyway, so you've got this. Seems to me you've got this synergy between the state, corporations, and the consumer, the consuming public, creating a plural identity for modern architecture, which we don't see in Europe because there's less building needed in a way. Like, we've already built our cities. The Victorian period in Britain, speaking to someone reasonably recently, that was when Britain was great. I know it's, setting aside the fact that it was a colonial country and did slavery, setting aside that's a slightly enormous elephant in the room. The cities it built off the back of that are the datum point against which it measures all quality. And so we've never had that freedom that the Americans have had to kind of take modernity and modernism, modern architecture, and just play with it to make new cities, to make new. And I think that's maybe, for me, where the big difference lies, is that we've done it all already by the time America's just starting up.
Well, there is a lot of truth in what you're saying. But of course, modernity is constantly changing across history. We can't just hold on to a point of the past when this notion was great, even though every country, including the United States, after all, it's Trump's major ploy is to say, make America great again under his autocratic rule as a new president king. Now, this notion of things having been better in the past was rarely something that Americans felt, but they do now increasingly. And I think it's disturbing and something that architects everywhere in the world should be trained to address rather than say, they just don't understand. It's too easy to dismiss difficulties that people have about modern life and about modern architecture. And architects, unfortunately, tend to be dismissive about people who, quote, don't understand, rather than just say, what can I do to try to listen to what they're saying, to take off my blinders that insist you should only look at the important buildings by important architects and everything else is dreck. Those are bad habits. They're not a way to learn. They're not a way to exchange ideas with people. And you know, I'm a teacher. I'm a journalist. I want to try to debate and I want to learn. I don't think I know it all, and I will simply pass that on. I fill up the empty vessel with my knowledge. There's a lot to do. And that has been another mainstay of American intellectual life. The notion of change, the notion that we can't control what we're doing, but we can learn from it. It's interesting that the major American philosophical innovation was called pragmatism, as you probably know, which emerged in the very late 19th century. And it was a matter of not of pragmatic, just get things done, get to business, which is something Americans have been criticized for. But it was a philosophy that asked not what is the essence of abstract ideas, but what do ideas do in the world? If they don't make much of a difference, then it's not really a very important idea. And that's, I think, a distinctly American approach that has infiltrated the very best of American architecture. It's also striking that the man who coined the term pragmatism, Charles Peirce, a philosopher, later said, I wish I had called it fallibilism. We all need to learn that we can be wrong. Mm. We often are. That's very hard for human beings to admit. But architects need to be able not to get depressed by it, but to learn something from it, and to keep expanding our network of people we talk to. Architects often will talk to modern artists and will listen to modern music, but it becomes important to do what the great philosopher John Dewey called expand your constituency. How can architects get beyond just talking to other architects? Mm-hmm. It limits us unnecessarily.
Yeah, I think this idea of the pragmatic quality of American modern architecture is really, really, really does contrast to, I think, what we see as the rules-based nature of high modernism of the European tradition, where there is a very right way of doing things. And as a consequence of that, that kind of pragmatism, you end up with, yeah, IIT and Taliesin. You end up with postmodernism and Michael Graves doing kind of crazy things, and you know, all of the wildness of the postmodern years. And then you end up with this situation where America is leading the charge in terms of its environmental architecture as well, building the technologies that will create low carbon, zero carbon buildings and so on and so forth. So it's, I think my wife's a Californian, you see, so she gets frustrated when, and she studied philosophy at Berkeley, so she gets frustrated when British people equate being pragmatic and pragmatism as a philosophy. She's like, they're not the same thing at all. But I'm constantly having to keep this in mind. But one of the things that the way you're talking about this, and that I picked up in the book as well, is this way that, and I called it scale jumping, which is really a phrase from Arjun Appadurai, the anthropologist and geographer from NYU. But it's the way that you see the connection between the global narrative of modernity and modernist architecture, and then the very, very personal scale. And I'm really fascinated by this. And one of the particular examples that I picked on, to go back to some of the work that you said you had done at the beginning, was around women and women's role as not only designers, but as members of the public, as consumers of space and of stuff, and how their needs and desires and changing identities in the 20th century, in the late 19th and 20th century, was instrumental in producing modern architecture.
It's absolutely true that the phrase actually was the new woman, and she was iconically young and American, and she wanted to have a different kind of home that would be easy to keep up, mm-hmm. that would be modern and healthy, and let her have more time outside the home, whether for work, as a clerical worker in a factory, as a professional. There were more women working in the United States in 1910 than there were until 1970. That was an extraordinary period of new opportunities for women, and they wanted to have fun as well. One of the things that was fascinating with a lot of the new public places in cities during these years was this sense that you could mix with people you didn't know. You could have encounters with total strangers. You could fall in love with somebody at an amusement park or a museum. That wasn't acceptable, obviously, in elite society, but the elite was drawn toward these kinds of exciting encounters, and they required this new woman who would be game for it all, who would be excited. I decided to include, not making a big deal of it, but just to include women modern architects in every chapter. And some of them I knew about. Some were amazing discoveries. My favorite, perhaps, is a woman named Marion Manley, who in 1948 designed a new, very modern campus for the University of Miami. And it was published on the cover of every major American magazine of architecture and all over Europe as well, and was called the first modern university. It was informal, it was geared to an extraordinary but very difficult climate. It reused a lot of surplus material from World War II. It was geared toward these GIs who were often now married and having families who were going to university. So it was a different kind of student life. And she did all of this, and it's gorgeous. I mean, it's bizarre, perhaps, that this later on became the home of a kind of postmodern new urbanism, but it doesn't create a new way of thinking, but it's gorgeous to see. It really, if you go to Miami, you should go to the campus because it's still very beautiful and exciting, and a good model.
Yeah, I just looked at it online. I mean, it's so beautiful.
It is.
And so Miami.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that is intriguing about American modern architecture is that it's much less placeless than a lot of modern architecture is criticized for being. Not that there aren't countless examples of that, but there is and has long been a distinctive way that American modern architects, whether they are immigrants from Europe or from Asia or native born, they engage that local climate, its materials, its site, its particular landscape, and they make the architecture better by thinking about both the natural environment, the local materials, and the way of life. New England is different from the Midwest, which is different from Northern or Southern California. And obviously, the same exists in every European country, but it's perhaps less pronounced in part because this is such a huge country. But it's also something that architects took up. Modern architects believed that responding to these regional differences was important and would create better architecture that fit into the place socially and environmentally and economically, that it would fit for people. And that's not something that all modernists have been concerned about.
No. I mean, one of the arguments against, I suppose, one of the arguments that you encounter when you're reading more broadly, perhaps, than just architecture, is that modernity constitutes a form of dominion. That modernism, so there's a lot of kind of post-colonial literature which tries, which effectively places, or it fragments the origin story of modernism into various places, and it says, you know, either Bruno Latour's "We have never been modern," or "We're all modern at the same time," and it's a kind of paradigmatic.
Hegemonic, shift.
Yeah.
Obviously both.
But does American? Because I asked this question, the first of you, is to be modern to be American, which is me being rather a controversialist for no good reason, but. Why not? And then asking, like, how does America, if the supposition is reasonable, how does America balance this idea of this contextual modernism, which is very responsive to individual needs, particularly, I think, actually, to the needs of people that have, as you know, note, sort of underrepresented within architectural production, right? People, you know, you get houses given to people rather than, and you mentioned race and gender and class and so on. How does it square that circle? That it's kind of like America is delivering modernity around the world and it's using architecture to do this.
Well, that has often been true. It has had negative impacts. And it has unquestionably been done under the aegis of large corporations in the American state that want a hegemony from that. Can't simply dismiss it. That's too negative. Ultimately, I'm an American optimist who deals with major problems that we have to address and try to do something about.
Yeah.
I think in part because it's such a large and vast country, there are these important differences from one place to the next. But there is a distinct sense. Sometimes it's perhaps rather naive to say America means this or Americans stand for that. And why isn't the whole world more like America? But that is not a way of looking at modern life. Modern life is experienced differently. In the Midwest, in a small town, in a suburb in California, in a large city, be it Detroit or Boston or New York or Miami, those variations are as important and sometimes as contentious as the commonalities and, unfortunately, the homogeneity that comes with that, that is often imposed. It's cheaper for industry to want to make the same kind of houses. But one of the things that was, from the start, really interesting about American prefabrication, which transformed American housing, prefab techniques and even prefab houses, was that it was geared not to standardization, which we usually think of with industrial production, but to the notion of variety, or as Americans would put it, choice. You can choose the kind of house you want. Now, the choices may be very superficial, frankly, and modernism as a style is varied. That most people here, even now, most architects, no longer feel drawn to the orthodox modernism of the modern movement, with spare, uniform, unornamented, functional building. That tended to be fairly uniform. They're more drawn toward varieties, but modernism has given them all kinds of varieties. And great, all of the good American modern architects have encouraged that. They want to have variety themselves. They want to have not a school of thought or a lexicon of rules, but opportunities, change, variety. And that can sometimes be a bit overwhelming, but it's also a way for people to think about what they want, what they need, what they'd like to see change in the world.
Yeah, that's a very nice way of putting it. You've picked on some of the authors, some of the greatest of the architects, and you've picked on in your book lesser known characters, and you sent me the names of two, and I haven't got the names of them in front of me as well, are contemporary architects who are designing beautiful, very contextual forms of modernism. But I wondered, you mentioned earlier, and maybe you can tell me maybe suggest some of the finest examples, some of your favorite examples that you picked, that you found in the book. I mean, you pick on Richard Neutra. Obviously, he's a great and very well-known architect, but his high modernism is still inflected by his context in a way that I think is surprising to people when they think about high modernism, isn't it? You get this all the way through. Louis Kahn does it. It's only Mies van der Rohe who comes in with his great square blocks and puts them everywhere.
That's a good way of putting it. Well, I think it's exciting that there continue to be positive shifts and changes and new developments in American modern architecture. I would really put it in three important categories. One is this interest that young people are passionate about, and rightly so, in the environment, in questions of sustainability. And I think one of the most exciting contemporary architects is a woman named Jean Gang, who is based in Chicago and New York. And she has always been committed. She used to work for Rim Koolhaas and then started her own practice only in 1990. And she, for every project, she chooses issues about sustainability to focus on. It's not just sustainability in a big, vague, abstract way, but she chooses a material to really focus on, to think about how to use less of the structural reinforcement, for instance, or how to respond to climate. One of her first and most beautiful high rises was called Aqua, which was like the water of these beautiful curved balconies on all four sides of this high rise. And they were designed to deal with the wind factor in Chicago, which is really intense. Mies did not really respond enough to that when he did Lakeshore Drive and other kinds of apartment buildings, but she did, and he created beautiful architecture. She thought about each of these issues. She even thinks for every project, and again, the focus on particulars, I think, is really crucial for students to take up. We don't live in abstractions. She even takes up an animal species that is endangered and thinks how she can address that. One of the examples is that every year, millions of birds die from flying into plate glass windows. Yeah. And so she's thought of ways that she could address those problems. She can't stop it entirely, but she tries to address them.
Yes, Studio Gang are great. Really, really good. And I do like that. I do like that. And there is this, again, something that we touched on earlier, this idea that technology is at the heart of the modern, using technology to generate new knowledges and new experiences. This idea of the excitement of modernity, I think, is, you know, it's very evident in her work. And you track, obviously, you track in the book through, it's a more or less chronological description of modern architecture in America, and we get to this kind of Bretton Woods kind of moment where America takes on the mantle of being the, I suppose it happens before that, but we get this new economy that comes out of it. So that interested in is what happens to modernism. So if we move back from Studio Gang, who are trying to, in a way, to me, put right some of the alienation that emerges. So we have this early beginning of modernity, which is contextual, it's high, and it is inflected by European kind of absolutes in certain respects. Mm-hmm. But there's a kind of attention brought in by this democratic voice that's characteristic of the American continent or the United States. And then something goes kind of weird in the post-90s, 60s period where there's this, you talk about replication a little bit of the great masters and the problems that, you know, of the Miesian Tower, for example, and the problems that creates. But you also mentioned this idea of consumerism and that the market is instrumental in defining what modern architecture becomes, because it's a very responsive device for understanding popular will, popular ideas. But it seems to go a bit weird at a certain point. And we get to this point in the 1980s where architecture sort of fragments and the Frank Gehrys of this world with their deconstructivism start doing an architecture which is modern technologically, but isn't modern in the emancipatory, arguably, let us say, arguably isn't modern in the emancipatory idea or model that we had come to expect of it. It's not trying to, you know, like a sanatorium or a housing block. It's not trying to do something that's for people, for the good of people. It's trying to do something, perhaps, I don't know what it's, you know, is it, I wondered whether you could talk perhaps a little bit about this you call it a disjuncture. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. At this moment that we're now kind of through the sustainability movement and the ecology movement are trying to put right in a way.
Well, it's, you've raised a lot of important issues. In Frank Gehry's favor, I would say that he, after all, has designed a lot of really much loved public buildings. He has, in particular, made museums and concert halls that work beautifully. And that bring a lot of joy to the people who make art, who make music, and who enjoy them. He's also been really, he began, after all, as a commercial architect. He built shopping malls and shopping centers and department stores. And he learned a lot about how to entice people, how to excite them, how to challenge them in titillating but emancipatory ways. I think that he's designed some extraordinary buildings. And one of the things that especially impresses me, for instance, in the Guggenheim Bilbao, is it's not just the shapes in and of themselves, but it's the way that it fits into this old industrial city. You can't tell at any of the edges where the Guggenheim Museum begins and where the surrounding industrial infrastructure ends. They are fluid. He makes these become part of the world around them. And I think that is intriguing to people. And I don't believe that architecture should be jarring, but sometimes Gehry thinks that you have to be a little disrupted in order to see things in a new way, to experience the potential of what he called cheapskate materials, like the way that he was very drawn to chain link fences, for instance, and off the shelf kinds of modern materials, because he wanted people to think differently about it. Now, his neighbors, when he built his own house in 1978, and he transformed his career at that point, the neighbors hated it, not surprisingly, and a little bit like the issue of racial integration, they kept insisting it would lower their property values, but they really just didn't like it. It wasn't what the home was supposed to look like. But he wanted to make people think differently. And it fascinated people. And then even more, these public buildings and these really exciting, ingenious, often relatively inexpensive houses that he designed for, in particular, first for his artist friends and then for patrons, got people to think differently. And there is an aspect of modern architecture that is about opening people up to new ideas, not forcing them on, but having them sometimes be a little ruffled by that. So I like Gehry. It's actually interesting for your audience who are architecture students, is the first volume of the Catalogue Les Aunes of Gehry's sketches has just come out, edited by a good friend, Jean-Louis Cohen. And it's extraordinary because you see in the sketches how he takes an idea and works on it in different ways, thinks about changes and adaptations. It's not as if he gets an idea and sketches it on a cocktail napkin and that's it. He imposes that. He was constantly pushing himself in particular with this house, and that transformed his career.
Well, I stand corrected. I mean, I do actually like Frank Gehry, and I think his bio museum in Panama City is a really great. I mean, obviously, I haven't visited it in person, but it's a absolutely beautiful piece of work. Yes. And does an enormous amount of, as you say, good. I mean, Michelangelo wasn't exactly subtle, was he? and we're grateful for him. No, it's not a criticism so much of Gehry's output, so much as it's sort of trying to understand, I suppose, how in America this emancipatory, well, I suppose it's rather worthy kind of high modernism. We get a lot of it in Britain in the forms of things like brutalism, rather worthy. Civically minded architecture becomes rather repetitious. It gets rolled out too much, too far. It mm-hmm. becomes acontextual. And then what the deconstructivists and that disjuncture moment that you mentioned, 1985 to the present, is a kind of recontextualizing. But it's doing, you know, it's working once again on this idea of excitement and a different form of emancipation, not something that's kind of so sackcloth and ashes, perhaps.
Well, it's striking to me that those years, Americans were really turning away from many of their concepts of improving the world and having better housing for everyone. Mm. A whole range of basic tenets of what modern architecture had always stood for.
Mm.
And it's perhaps especially striking that even today, many non-architects associate modern architecture with the worst of American public housing. Places like Pruitt-Igoe, places that were bombed because they were so unsuccessful, they were so deplorable to live in, they were so dangerous, they were so not only unloved, but hated by people. And of course, it didn't help attitudes that many of the residents were poor and black. Mm. But it wasn't simply a matter of racism. This had become a cheap way of providing housing for largely black, but many white people who were poor, who lived especially in American cities, but in small towns as well. And it's really striking that that with this hatred of public housing as modern architecture, there was Richard Nixon was president, and he issued a moratorium on all social housing in the United States. We just wouldn't have any because it would all be awful. It was also because he disliked the poor black, largely female population that was associated with this. He refused to see the ways in which this was bad modern architecture. This was done on the cheap, and it was done with almost no maintenance. And so things were constantly breaking down. And it wasn't because it was modern architecture. It was because there was no money for keeping these buildings up, and these people, quote, didn't deserve it. And so that made a major change in American social housing. It moved from being a federal responsibility to being local, both municipal and state. And that happened at a time that these changes were going on in terms of modern architecture, that it began to look at local vernaculars, at regional kinds of massing, at local materials, at clusters of buildings, at the importance of site planning. And that has created some really wonderful new social housing, much of it for the formerly homeless. That is, I think, one of the great successes, ongoing successes into the 20th century, into the 21st century, I mean, of what American modern architecture could do. But it came because there was this widespread public aversion that modern architecture is homogeneous and boring and causes violence. Sociologists who declared that you needed to have defensible space because the poor were awful people and were going to be murdering and robbing each other and you if you didn't coop them up. It's in fact very striking that I think a lot of the most interesting kinds of our social housing since the 1990s has been radically different from this earlier modern architecture, in large part because, again, of a woman who wasn't an architect, but who was fascinated by and works with a number of major architects, Koenig Geisenberg and Michael Molson, and in particular in the Los Angeles region. And in her credit, she was interested in reform, in particular for the homeless. And this had become a huge problem in American cities, that there were homeless people just pushed into what they called welfare hotels that mm-hmm. were cheap hotels. They were awful, they were smelly, they were dangerous, and they were very overcrowded. And she created in 1991 the idea that you've probably heard of because it's now spread all over the world, of what's called supportive services. Not just that this should be engaging public architecture, but it should be enhancing private architecture for the people who live there as individuals and as communities, and that they needed services, financial training. They needed to have drug rehab. They needed to have help with getting a job. They needed to have all kinds of assistance. And the architecture couldn't do it, but it could create these services. And she was very smart about it because she said, these shouldn't be the first thing you see when you walk into a building. It should be off to the side. Mm-hmm. So people can feel proud about their space, their community, and still get the services that they need. It was very wise architectural insight.
Mm. I didn't pick up the name. Did you even mention her name?
I think I mentioned it. I have so much, I just crammed it all in. But I think she was actually a former student of mine. And she's amazing. She got one of these MacArthur. Okay,
what is her name? You've got to tell me your name again.
Her name is Roseanne, Roseanne Haggerty, Haggerty.
A good Irish name.
Exactly. Good Irish Catholic girl. She started she'd gone to a meeting at City Hall about the problem of these homeless shelters.
Yeah.
And the judge turned to her and said, well, Ms. Haggerty, would you like to buy the Times Square Hotel for $1 and see what you could do with it? And she said, well, yes, Your Honor. And she transformed the place. I mean, she was terrified, she said. She came to see me and said, I'm going to have to put off doing my schoolwork for a while because I've just taken on this major new undertaking. But she created an organization called Common Ground Community, making a community among the residents, but also tying them to their neighbors and to these services, both within the building and beyond. And it has transformed housing for the formerly homeless, all kinds of social housing, not only in the United States, but in many parts of the world. She travels all over the place. She is seen as a kind of guru for having thought of new ways of getting people as residents, but also as neighbors, to be engaged in making better places to live. You know, it's idealistic, but it's had amazingly positive impacts. She also did something really nice. She started the campaign for many of the homeless people had been in the American military.
Mm-hmm.
And they were suffering from PTSD, and they were alcoholics and other kinds of problems. But she said, the problems don't matter. She called it housing first and said, we just need to have places, decent places for these people to live. Mm-hmm. And I want to create a million. And she did it in a year. And she got people to give her money because they cared about these vets. And she took over places that were either partially or fully vacant, but she built a lot of new housing. And one of the most interesting is a project out in Brooklyn called the Skirmerhorn that was a combination of social housing for the formerly homeless, a very beautiful market rate row of houses, of beautiful modern townhouses, and a ballet school for the neighborhood, including many of the residents of the social housing. And it's gorgeous. And she was told, well, this just won't work. The townhouses sold out in a day. People love it. They engage their neighbors. They're not holding hands and singing Kumbaya, but they get along. And, you know, cities are about learning to get along. So we're small towns for that matter.
It's very beautiful. It's a very beautiful story. I wanted to finish by talking about sustainability and ecology, but I think, which we can do if you like. And my question, it's really interesting. That's really, really interesting examples of people using their architecture, particularly women, again, using their architectural education to actually do something that has a very personal kind of quality to it, but a very kind of dynamic, you know, this exciting and uplifting nature of modernism, which is this, you know, it's a repeated refrain in your book, which I really like. And I just wondered whether you had any thoughts about this kind of turn towards ecology that you see actually right at the beginning. And my question that I wrote to you was, is this turn to ecology really a return to the roots of American modernism? Was there this basically 50-year period between about 1968 and 50 years later, whenever that is?
2010, let's see.
where the wheels come off a little bit. And what we're doing now is returning, and ecology is a way of talking about context, but that at the one hand combines us with situated sites, people, places, realities, but also connects us to a kind of geopolitical global thing. So it does this kind of perfect modernist balancing act.
Well, while I am, as you can tell, relatively optimistic and positive, and I think that's very true and very exciting and absolutely essential for our human future, there's a phenomenon that is fascinating to me that you've probably heard about and even seen some examples of, called the super talls. That is a new modern skyscraper. These had begun as office buildings, but the super talls were luxury housing that were over 300 meters high. They began with a few examples in Chicago by Fazid Khan of SOM, looking at how to handle the environmental and structural problems, especially in a very windy city, of these tall buildings. But then it sort of stayed dormant for a while until the 1990s, when Asia began building these super talls. And then they were built in New York City and in Chicago and now elsewhere. These were a very different kind of architecture. Mm. Amazing structures, mm-hmm. but they turned their back on the city, on their surroundings, literally having blank walls because these luxury tenants did not want to have to see ordinary people. They wanted to live on their own. Hudson Yards over on the west side is one of the, I think, despicable examples of these super tall buildings and very fancy, exciting public buildings and commerce. But there's a new book about these called Super Talls by my friend Stefan Ahl, a Dutch architect who has immigrated to the US. And he actually designed one of these in 1990 in Hong Kong, which is where Hong Kong and China had most of them at that era. And he has the excitement. He knows the challenge and the thrill of making something this tall. But he then has the intelligence to say, but there are problems. There are environmental problems that we can address, but aren't doing so. They cast huge shadows on their surroundings. They create a terrible carbon footprint. They are problematic for all of us, but especially because of this focus on the very rich not having to live with the rest of us, the boy poor. That goes against, of course, all of the basic principles of how modern architecture has been understood. And we can't forget the fact that you probably know, but the United States has, since 1985, and especially since 2008, had greater income inequality than ever before in its history and than any other country that's comparable in the world. And that's, of course, leading a lot of people to feel discouraged, even despairing. They're angry about these changes, and they're thrashing around about politics, about race, about women, about all kinds of things that they're blaming for these problems. And we need to find a way, as architects, as citizens, as human beings, to address those problems. I really like it that Stefan has made this effort to show how exciting these super tall modern buildings could be, but to also point out the fallibilism of it, the problems that it causes for the environment, but really for social world in cities and inequalities in cities, which we as architects, again, we can't solve the problems, but we have to address them. And it's a big challenge for the 21st century.
I'm very struck by this notion of inequality because, you know, a couple of years ago, your richest man flew a personal rocket into space.
I know.
And people clapped. People clapped and thought it was clever. And I thought it was one of the most obscene things I've ever seen. I mean, it makes Louis XIV look like he wasn't even trying.
I mean, that's a very good comparison. It's true. And they believe the state is me, l'état c'est moi, in that same way. These are so privileged, so arrogant, so manipulative. This 1% of Americans who are the very rich. And they make more money than the other 99%. It is obscene. And architects are by and large beholden to these rich patrons for their buildings and patrons for museums and schools and universities and all kinds of public buildings. And the changes in how our workplaces are organized, it's awful what places like Amazon do. I mean, we all rely on them, but it's not the best kind of work. It's cruel and ruthless. And
so the question is how do we emancipate ourselves as modern architects? How do we use the motivation of the joy and the possibility and opportunity of modernity to emancipate ourselves from essentially as architects from dependence upon this kind of logic of escalating inequality and escalating environmental abuse. I mean, that's the other thing that goes along with Bezos flying his rocket into space. The guy had the temerity to turn up at COP26 and tell people about climate change. I mean, he just burnt about as much oxygen as Kenya would breathe in a year. And so how do we do this? Like, what can we do as educators, and what can we do as young learners to start imagining a way of doing architecture? And you've given some examples of people who've learned architecture but haven't become architects necessarily, mm-hmm. or people who've been architects who've stepped away from it. But how do you go into the trade and take control?
Well, I think you can only take control project by project, and through education. And architects need not to indoctrinate the public mm-hmm. about their ideas, but to learn from people about these problems and to figure out, again, it's one of the things I like in Jeannie Gang. She takes project by project. She takes on ways to deal with sustainability, to deal with creating communities for the people who are residents or who are going to public places. We need to take on new kinds of workplaces, small scale. But one of the things that can happen is you can take some large scale modern buildings. One of the most, we'll end with this, that one of the most interesting is a place called the Brooklyn terminal that was built at the very end of World War I and then repurposed during World War II, a huge complex by Cass Gilbert, an amazing combination of factories of different sort and of infrastructure for transporting things. And it's become one of the most interesting ways of encouraging small local businesses, often minority and women-owned businesses, to experiment, to exchange ideas, to encourage each other. And a lot of architects are rightly excited by these opportunities. We aren't going to transform the world through them, but the example can really give people hope. And all we can do is have hope and do things bit by bit, piecemeal. I mean, one of the principles of pragmatism was to see the world of improvements as patchwork, little pieces here and there. It can't be done in a holistic fabric. It's only going to be pieces that will change, that will fray, that will vary, but that's good. But architects have to take on the responsibility. I once had a wonderful man come and speak to a class of mine, and he made a very interesting point to me, saying architecture can't create change and improvement and progress in the world, but architects can help do that. As an individual, you have to think, what are your priorities? What are the things that you want to do on the side? What are the ways that you want to experiment? It's not, again, a huge picture of yourself and the profession, but it's making an effort as an individual architect. And then as groups, as museum exhibitions, as all kinds of things that we can do to publicize these possibilities. But the Navy terminal is a great example.
Brilliant. We'll finish there. Thank you so much, Gwen.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ambrose.
That was bordering on amazing, was it not? Thanks to Gwen for persevering and for sharing. Thanks to Reaction for the book. Please see the podcast description for links to it and to a great talk Gwen gave in 2012 with Michael Kimmelman entitled Who's Listening for Columbia's GSAPP. And there's a link too to Gwen talking about her role on History Detectives. And of course, please like, subscribe, follow and share A is for Architecture. Cheers.